This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Two of TV's greatest sitcoms starred Mary Tyler Moore, The Dick Van Dyke Show, and, of course, The Mary Tyler Moore Show. Over the years, Mary Tyler Moore has played several extremes very convincingly. The sitcom Mary, the person everyone wants as their best friend, and the cold, steely mother she portrayed in the film Ordinary People. Currently, she can be seen playing another uptight mother in the comic movie Flirting with Disaster. Terry Gross spoke with Mary Tyler Moore last fall. Her autobiography, after all, had just been published. She told Terry that her first big break in show business was playing the happy Hot Point elf for Hot Point appliance commercials broadcast during the Ozzie and Harriet show.
Happy Hot Point was the logo of Hot Point Appliances come to life, an elf, a little figure with a shock of blonde hair protruding from her little gray pixie cap that also had ears on it. But I was Happy Hot Point, and I would, in these commercials, be superimposed on the ice cube trays, skating, popping out of the washing machine, speaking to Harriet Nelson and saying things like, "Hi, Harriet, aren't you glad you use Hot Point appliances?" Except my voice was higher then, so it sounded a lot more pixie-ish than it does now. What had happened was that at that time, and this was immediately after graduating from high school, I also got married immediately after graduating from high school. And about a month after that, I was pregnant. And the commercials were almost impossible to do anymore because I had my breasts bound down to begin with, even before I was pregnant, because pixies are supposedly of neuter gender. And to try to do that after I was even 1 month along, and certainly into two and three, was impossible. And so we had to stop. And I think they just went to straight commercials after that. And I went on to happily have my baby a few months after that.
Well, after you had your baby, you were the voice of the woman in the answering service for the TV detective Richard Diamond.
Right. That was played by David Janssen, and it was, I guess it had started on radio, and one of the successful elements of it was a character called Sam, short for Samantha, who was the answering service woman who took Richard Diamond's telephone messages. This was, of course, predating answering machines. And he would check in with me two or three times every episode, and I would answer in the sexiest imaginable voice, "Hi, Mr. T. I have some messages for you." And nobody ever saw Sam. You were allowed to imagine her to be your idea, your fantasy of the most gorgeous creature ever, certainly far from the reality of Mary Tyler Moore, who at the time was a fast 23 or 22 years old, freckle face, all-American girl next door type.
Now, let me jump ahead to the Dick Van Dyke Show. What were you told about the character of Laura?
Just that she was going to be a wife, a television wife, and that really had its classical parameters and dimensions, and they were established, and they hardly ever varied except as to whether or not the wife was the star of the show, in which case she was the funny one, or if she were the straight man for the male star, and she was then totally supportive. But all these wives were kind of obedient and, you know, a representative of the vows to love, honor, and obey. They hardly varied from that. And with Carl Reiner's character, the way she was written, Laura actually had opinions of her own, and while she was asserting herself, she also didn't make Dick Van Dyke look like a dummy. It was a matter of two people. I mean, society's expectations at that point still said, "Hey, wait a minute, lady, you only go so far here." But I think we broke new ground, and that was helped by my insistence on wearing pants, you know, jeans and capri pants at the time, because I said I've seen all the other actresses and they're always running the vacuum in these little flowered frocks with high heels on, and I don't do that, and I don't know any of my friends who do that, so why don't we try to make this real, and I'll dress on the show the way I do in real life.
But it wasn't that easy. The sponsors were afraid you'd look brazen.
Right. They pointed specifically to, they used a term, cupping under. And I can only assume that that meant my, you know, my seat, that there was a little too much definition. And so they allowed me to continue to wear them in one episode, one scene per episode, and only after we checked to make sure that there was as little cupping under as possible. But
cupping under referring to the fit of your pants.
The fit of the pants,
on
yes.
your behind.
On my behind, right. But within a few weeks, we were sneaking them into a few other scenes in every episode, and they were definitely cupping under, and everyone thought it was great. And the funny thing is, you know, women liked me. They were not envious of the fact that their husbands had a crush on me. It was okay with them. They were the first to, you know, when I would meet people, they'd say, my husband loves you so much, and he thinks you're so sexy. And this was an odd thing, because they were also able to identify with me as a friend, as a girlfriend. There was no resentment, no fear.
Yeah, well, I think that speaks so well for the character and your portrayal of her. Now, how did you come up with the voice to say, oh, Rob?
I don't know. I guess it began with the cry. The first time I cried was the episode in which Laura bleaches her hair blonde, looks in the mirror, and with her friend Millie's help decides she looks more like Harpo Marx than what her goal had been. And so she quickly tries to dye it back before Rob gets home from work. Now, this is a real stretch of the imagination. She decides to dye one half of her head back, not being able to get the other half done before Dick walks in the door. And so she greets him, half blonde, half brunette, and sobbing. And I had always been a big fan of Nanette Fabre, who worked with Carl Reiner and Sid Caesar on the shows. And I loved her humor. I loved the way she cried. And so when I was called upon to bring forth the tears in my scene, I'm not sure how much of it was out-and-out stolen from Miss Fabre and how much of it was just a matter of influence, but there was definitely a cracking in the voice and an inability to maintain a tone and a certain amount of verbal yodeling that took place. And from that came, oh, Rob!
I have another question about Laura Petrie's look.
Yeah.
Laura wore a flip. Perfect little flip.
Yes.
Whose idea was the flip? And how were you wearing your hair in real life at the time?
In real life, I was wearing it in a flip, but it wasn't quite as backcombed and lacquered as it was on the show. I mean, that thing had so much hairspray on it, you could hang clothes from it.
When you say that thing, was it your hair or was it a wig?
Yeah, it was my hair, but it was quite thoroughly sprayed and done by somebody else. But my... in person in between shows, that was the way I wore it. It was just a little limper.
Well, let's talk about the Mary Tyler Moore Show, a show which I still love to watch. I'm so glad that Nick at Night carries these shows. I still love to watch the Dick Van Dyke Show and Mary Tyler Moore. Now, the Mary Tyler Moore Show got started because CBS wanted to build a series around you.
Mm-hmm.
And you and Grant Tinker hired people to, you know, come up with the idea, write a series. What was the original premise?
The original premise was not too different from the one that we ended up pursuing, but I was to be divorced from a doctor. And rather than having, as we ended up doing, having me live with this doctor through medical school and internship and residency and then been dumped, CBS felt that having been divorced was unacceptable from a societal point of view, that people would see nothing humorous in divorce. How could you possibly laugh at a woman who had a broken marriage in her past? And not only that, but my God, they would think you were divorced from Dick Van Dyke, the world's most wonderful, adorable person.
That's so silly.
Yeah. And instead, what's so odd from a morality point of view is that they found it acceptable that I had lived with this doctor, never married him, and then the relationship broke up and I went off to start my new life. So I don't know. Morality, I guess, is a very personal thing.
The character of Ted Baxter was originally conceived as being someone of your age.
Right.
And there might be some, like, romantic attraction between you.
Exactly. He was probably going to be tall, dark, and handsome. And instead, what walked through the door was Ted Knight. Short, white-haired, and handsome, yes, but not what you'd call a love interest. But the writers, the writer-producers, Jim and Alan, were so open, and they saw this man, and they began to think potential. All right, so it isn't our original idea, but oh, wow, look and feel and salivate over all the juicy stories we could do in another direction.
I think one of the real famous moments in television openings, one of the famous freeze frames is you throwing your hat in the air in the opening of the show with the jingle underneath.
Yeah.
Do you remember that moment?
Oh, do I? It was freezing cold. It was in Minneapolis in January, I think, or February. And we didn't know what we were doing. We were just there to grab a lot of footage that shows a young woman's exuberance, being in a new city, looking around, gazing at the sights. And I had in my hand a hat, a little beret that my aunt had given me for Christmas. And I had packed that along with whatever other warm things that I had, which weren't too many because I was a Californian, to go to Minneapolis to do these film spots. And Jim Brooks said, "Oh, I have a good idea, Beery. Take that hat, put it on your head, and now run into the intersection, and it'll be all right. We'll watch for cars." And throw it up in the air as if to say, "This is my town, and I'm celebrating my life that is taking place." And I did it, and luckily, magically, wasn't hit by a car, although I got some pretty strange looks. And in fact, I guess it must be in every episode, you can see this one woman in the background who looks at me as if not only am I the world's strangest person, but that she would like to personally lock me up. But it's interesting, isn't it, that something that becomes burned in people's impressions and memories can happen so happenstancely out of nowhere. It wasn't written. It was just a spur-of-the-moment idea.
So that traffic was the real thing.
Oh, yeah, it was. And it's a good thing I didn't have to speak any lines because my lips weren't working. It was so cold. I literally could not form words.
Huh.
Mary Tyler Moore talking with Terry Gross. Mary Tyler Moore currently appears in the new movie, Flirting with Disaster. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Mary Tyler Moore.
I have a colleague here who said, "The Mary Tyler Moore Show made me who I am today, single." And I thought that was particularly funny because, you know, all those years you were playing Mary Tyler Moore, you had no idea what it was like to be single. You got married as soon as you got out of high school. You divorced, but you were only single for about 6 months before marrying Grant Tinker.
That's right. Boy, you've read the book, haven't you?
Yes.
Yes.
So really, you'd never lived that kind of single life.
No, I hadn't. And when Grant and I finally ended our marriage and I went to New York to do a Broadway play, Whose Life Is It Anyway?, I decided to stay in New York and try to capture my life for myself. I had never been on my own. I had never experienced any of the situations that Mary Richards had lived for the rest of the world every week. And I set about to make that happen for myself. I dated. I made friends. I had a little apartment. I did my own shopping and schlepped my own clothes to the dry cleaner and back and the laundry and all of that stuff. And I sort of generally played house. But in real life.
I'm interested in hearing a little bit about your own family when you were growing up, since after all, you know, you portrayed one of the most famous couples on television on the Dick Van Dyke Show, and then had a wonderful family of friends and colleagues.
Yes.
On the Mary Tyler Moore Show. When you were growing up, your own family was probably what we'd now call dysfunctional.
Yeah, yeah, I suppose so. It's an overused phrase, and I wish we could be a little more specific about it.
I agree.
I didn't mean to criticize you for that.
No, I didn't take it that way.
my mother and father were very much the couple that Grant Tinker and I became. They say that you do follow the patterns that you grow up in, and this was certainly true in my case. Wasp, repressed, unable to deal with things that are uncomfortable. pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps, not discussing anything that's ugly or unpleasant, and just muddling through. A little of Beth Jarrett in Ordinary People came mm-hmm. from those people, from myself. And I emulated that with Grant Tinker. My father is a very well-educated intellectual, a lover of classical music and classical literature. My mother was an English major. And everything was just perfect in that house, but nobody was talking to anybody.
Well, another thing that was less than perfect is your mother drank.
My mother was an alcoholic, as I was to become. Her alcoholism took another form from mine. She would, by the dint of determination, be sober for months at a time and then be unable to continue. And all of the problems that had been building up and she had been stuffing under the rug of her emotions would burst forth, and she would start drinking in the day, and she would not stop until somebody found the bottle and took it away and pretty much held her captive in the house until she sobered up and we were able to plead with her to stop, and then she would try again. Back then, nobody knew what we know about alcoholism today and the kind of counseling it takes and the kind of sharing and support that is needed to get through this, to break this cycle. They feel now, I think most scientists agree, that there is a genetic predisposition to alcohol, which in combination with other factors in life is going to almost guarantee some form of dependency in later life. My form of alcoholism was much more controlled because I grew up in that very uncomfortable, very sad situation, and I determined that I was never going to do that, never be drunk. And I probably never was really out-and-out drunk, and I certainly never drank during the daytime. But I wasted a lot of my time, and I forgot a lot because I didn't remember much of what had happened the night before. I got out of proportion angry about things that were really unimportant, but that's what alcohol does to you.
Did being an actress help you be able to drink and not show the signs of it? Help you cover it up?
Maybe so. I don't think so, though, because once your speech is slurred, once you lose balance, there's no way you can pretend that away. But I paced myself. I never allowed myself to drink any more than the company I was with. And that way nobody could judge me, nobody could see.
Did you drink alone?
Yeah, I did, but I was seldom alone, except when I moved to New York. And then I was alone, and then my drinking really escalated. Mm-hmm. And I found myself not going out after 5 o'clock and making sure that everything was set up for me to have my dinner there on the bed that was by the air conditioner, that was near the phone, that was near the television set, and that I had my blender full of drinks that I was concocting in an attempt to do something worthwhile in the kitchen. and it was a pretty sad lady that was emerging.
Were you afraid that the press would find out that you drank a lot, and it would be
I didn't think I drank a lot.
Oh, I see.
That's the amazing part of it. Uh-huh. Most alcoholics are in such a state of denial about their condition. They will blame everything but themselves for whatever is going on. I didn't have hangovers per se, but I found that it was getting very difficult to hold the eyeliner brush steady when I was applying my makeup in the morning. So I thought, I guess that's just something that happens when you enter your 40s, and it's a nerve-wracking city, so I'll just have to, take a little more time with it or use a thinner brush, whatever. And I had nobody to point out to me the lack of sense that I was making and the deterioration of my thinking.
You stopped drinking, I think it was, the mid-80s?
It was 11 years ago, yeah. I guess that was the mid-80s, yes. 86?
You did Betty Ford.
Right. And,
do you think your emotional character changed after you stopped drinking?
Oh, there's no question about it. In a way, I sometimes feel grateful that I did have this alcoholism, except that there were so many sad events that were caused by it that I can't wholeheartedly say that. But at least it got me to the Betty Ford Center, where I was able to, with the help of some counselors and a lot of group therapy sessions, examine myself and the way I handled my life and the way I handled problems and the way I reacted to any given situation, and was able to make major changes. I allowed myself to be imperfect. I allowed myself to make mistakes and laugh at it, to handle my real-life mistakes the way I handled the acting mistakes on the Dick Van Dyke Show, to think of those as positive steps forward rather than anything to be ashamed of.
Mary Tyler Moore stars in the new film Flirting with Disaster. The title of a recent autobiography is After All. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.